This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our speaker at a special City Club breakfast this morning was the senior senator from the state of Illinois, Dick Durbin. Senator Durbin announced several new programs. The Chicago HEAL Initiative, H-E-A-L, Hospital Engagement, Action, and Leadership, in which 10 major Chicago hospitals serving 18 underserved areas will become involved in working to improve the public health very broadly defined in each of their neighborhoods. This is not a federal mandate, but the 10 hospitals have agreed on a series of common goals that focus on the neighborhoods in Chicago with the most public health issues outside of doctors' offices. The programs will deal with trauma, jobs, education, housing, mental health, and medical care. It's a three-year plan that is dedicated to expanding economic opportunity in the served neighborhoods, increase hiring, increase goods and services from local vendors, expand summer employment, decrease health inequities, improve maternal health services, and reduce opioid prescription by at least 20%. He also said that $1.1 million, three grants, are being granted today to improve mental health services through the University of Chicago, another program with the University of Illinois at Chicago that will hire 20 master's degree social service workers, and programs with a couple of community organizations such as the Howard Brown Center. Senator Durbin also answered a few questions about the ongoing debate in Washington over Judge Kavanaugh's appointment. And basically he said, we will see what happens at the end of the week. But unless several Republican senators vote no, the Republicans have the numbers to put Justice Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court.
Our next speaker will introduce the senior United States Senator from Illinois. When one mentions the name of our featured speaker today, they think of Paul Douglas and Paul Simon. After his speech here a few years ago, Senator Durbin paid all 2,500-plus City Club of Chicago members the supreme compliment. And I quote, and it's on our website, the City Club of Chicago is an amazing forum which harkens back to an era of public discourse. There is a dynamic in your gathering which the mightiest blogs cannot touch. So let's thank you, Senator Durbin. Give him a round of applause. And we want to welcome Pastor Chris Harris. Pastor, you're on.
So I'm excited this morning because I've had the opportunity to work now for years with Senator Durbin on his federal legislation to support our children and families who are exposed to the daily trauma of violence, poverty, and inequity. He is a friend of Bright Star Community Outreach's TURN model, that is the Urban Resilience Network, in the greater Bronzeville community where we train faith and community leaders to provide trauma counseling based on an Israeli model called Natal. Our focus, counseling, mentorship, parenting, workforce development, and advocacy, strongly supported by our friends at Northwestern Medicine and University of Chicago Medicine. But more importantly, he is a champion for all communities, for neighbors, congregants, and all of our friends. He's the national leader on tough and critical, and I thank you for this, important political issues, from immigration reform even to criminal justice reform. He is a tireless champion for the Affordable Care Act and the basic human right for health care. And if you've seen the news lately, and particularly all last week, he's been a little busy dealing with the Supreme Court nomination. But we are all so honored to have him here today with us, back at home, to talk about another issue that I know is near and dear to his heart. Our city's gut-wrenching challenge of gun violence and trauma. There is no better fighter for our issues. And I know that when Senator Durbin sets out a new plan, he will absolutely deliver. Please, if you can, stand on your feet and help me to welcome our friend, our Senator Dick Durbin, to the podium.
Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you. Chris Harris, thank you for your kind words. More importantly, thank you for your life's work. What you do at BrightStar is amazing, and I hope all of you come to appreciate his commitment at BrightStar to Brownsville and the children of this city. A couple of my political friends may not have been acknowledged, and I just got to do my job here, my friends. I know Senate President John Cullerton was here and left, but Senator Kwame Raoul is still here. Glad you're here, Kwame. Treasurer Mike Frericks, there he is. Thank you, Mike. State Representative Christian, where are you? Christian, thank you for being here. Juan Salgado's here with the City Colleges. Thank you, Juan. Janice Jackson has been introduced. I don't know if, let me see who else I did. Andrea Zopp. Is Andrea Zopp here? Andrea, thank you for being here. Thank you for your help. Thanks to the City Club. This is a unique place. A full turnout for breakfast, and they're going to do the same thing again in just a few hours for lunch. There just aren't that many places in America, let alone in Chicago, that you can find this kind of opportunity to come together and to discuss virtually any issue that affects us in public life. Let me start off by telling you a story. It was 16 years ago, and the most famous rock musician in the world decided he was going to visit Chicago. His name was Bono, and he decided to come here, and he picked an incredible venue. People were puzzled by it. I was. He said, I want to speak at Wheaton College. Wheaton College. And he went to Wheaton College, and he had two topics he wanted to talk to. The pandemic of HIV/AIDS and the poverty around the world, particularly in Africa. It was an amazing moment for those of us who were lucky enough to be there. And it really changed a lot of lives. It changed Wheaton College. They established a group of young people who to this day continue in memory of that meeting to talk about global issues in a different context. And it changed my life in one respect. Dr. Jim Kim stood up. At the time, he was with the Harvard Medical School. Now he is president of the World Bank. And toward the end of the program, he said to the audience, because we'd focused so much on Africa and AIDS, he said, let me just tell you something. It is terrible in Africa, and we have to address it. But open your eyes. In the Western Hemisphere, the worst, most impoverished country is Haiti. And in Haiti, as Kwame knows better than most, we went there together. The poverty has come together with horrendous health outcomes. Kwame's dad was a doctor and dedicated his life to helping not only Chicago, but in Haiti. And as a result of those terrible situations in Haiti and the poverty, Dr. Kim said, take a look at your backyard, just an hour and a half on a plane outside of Miami. There's a terrible situation. I thought to myself, I've never been there. I'm going. And I did. Many times. And each time I went, I was inspired by the folks that stepped up and tried to help, but I was also humbled by the poverty and the terrible outcomes that you see and the heartbreaking failures in Haiti. Death, disease, suffering. And one of the clearest indicators of success or failure of any public health system is life expectancy. Life expectancy in Haiti is 19 years below average life expectancy in the United States. An hour and a half on a plane, 19 years. That's a stunning statistic. But you don't have to fly 1,800 miles to Haiti to see shocking differences in life expectancy. You don't have to get on a plane even to see a place where people live sicker and die younger than their neighbors, simply because of where they live. Just hop on the Blue Line. Go from the Loop, right where we are, go to West Garfield Park. Between those two Chicago neighborhoods, 5 miles apart, life expectancy plummets 16 years. How can that be? This great city, this vibrant urban economy, the greatest hospitals on earth, the best doctors, the best nurses, the best technology. How can this be? But all that and all the medical bounty we have is not there for everyone. The average lifespan in our neighborhoods is hardly better than that of Haiti, one of the poorest nations on earth. As it turns out, how healthy we are and how long we live depends as much on our zip code as our genetic code. I'll say more about that in a minute. Let me tell you something else about Haiti. It has the highest child mortality rate in our hemisphere. Nearly 1 in 5 Haitian infants and children don't make it to their fifth year. Tragically, many of Haiti's kids die from preventable disease, diarrhea, malaria, tuberculosis, pneumonia. But Chicago's children are dying from preventable deaths as well, but from a different epidemic, an epidemic of gun violence. 177 children have been killed by gun violence in this city since 2011. This year alone, 12 Chicago children have died from gun violence, one this past weekend. They are the youngest victims among the 317 Chicagoans killed with guns so far this year. Just last week, you read about it. Two boys, 16 and 17-year-olds, were shot to death on a crowded street at 3 o'clock in the afternoon near the CTA's 35th Street station. One was taken to Stroger Hospital, one of the best trauma care hospitals in America, the other to University of Chicago, the same level of quality. Neither of them survived. During one weekend in early August, gunfire took the lives of 12 people in this city. One weekend, 60 others were shot and survived. We start too many Monday mornings listening to headlines that sound more like battlefield reports than local news. How do we stop this? It's a question that everybody needs to ask and try to answer. Sure, we need better gun laws. I'm committed to them, and I have been for a long, long time. But I'm also a realist. With this Congress and this president, it's not going to happen. The cold, hard reality is that the people running Washington see it much differently. We're not going to get better federal gun laws until we get a different Congress and a different president. But that doesn't mean we do nothing. We must refuse to just wait and wring our hands while this epidemic of gun violence makes some of our city neighborhoods as deadly as war zones. If you look around you in this room, you're going to see leaders who are working hard to end the bloodshed. I could spend the rest of my time here just listing the names of so many of you that I've greeted this morning. Community leaders, faith leaders, leaders in business, education, philanthropy, so many different fields. I've given a lot of thought to what I could do. I visited the juvenile facility here in Cook County, sat down with the counselors and asked him, who are these kids? They're not born with guns in their hands. They're not born with a syringe in their hands. They can't, you know, they aren't waiting to get to a point where they can walk to make it to a crime scene. What happens in their lives that changes them so much? And as Pastor Harris and so many people in this room know, many of them tell us it's trauma, it's violence, it's the experience of life. It's something known in the literature as adverse childhood experiences. 20 years ago, there was a survey done, a research paper. They listed about 10 major adverse childhood experiences, from violence to divorce to broken families, on and on. And they said if you check 4 boxes on these, of these 10, we can tell you with real certainty what's going to happen to that young life, not just in terms of the outcome of their brushes with the law, but their physical health and their mental health. It is predictable as someone going into combat as a soldier, coming home in anguish over what they have witnessed, will need a helping hand. These kids do as well. I talked about that subject at the City Club the last time I was here. Put together a bill, and I'm happy to report to you that it has passed the Senate in the major opioid legislation. We're in conference, and I hope we can finish it in the next few days and send it to the president. So I asked myself, what more can we do? Where can I turn? And one day there was a moment of revelation. I've always said that the education of a senator is a daunting task, but I actually realized I was walking and driving past a resource that can make a significant difference. I'm talking about the hospital community here in the city of Chicago. The hospitals in this city are on the front lines of Chicago's gun violence epidemic. They provide quality care to heal bodies ripped apart by bullets. Remember that weekend in August? 72 shot and 60 survived. thanks to the incredible hospitals and doctors and nurses and so many others. But the ability of hospitals to reduce violence in Chicago goes far beyond their four walls. In addition to being world-class centers of research and healing, Chicago's hospitals are so much more in every neighborhood and in every community. They are change agents. They are credible. They have not only business plans, but mission statements. They are economic engines as well, even in some of the poorest neighborhoods. All told, hospitals in Cook County pump $49 billion a year into the local economy and employ over 230,000 people. They're often the largest employers in many communities. And they're also significant purchasers of goods and services, not just the latest medical technology, but food and laundry services and the support for their logistics. Their economic clout gives them the ability to reach far beyond their four walls and clinics and change the communities and neighborhoods that they live in. I'm here this morning with the CEOs and highest-ranking executives from 10 of the largest hospitals serving the city of Chicago. The men and women who are here representing them are proven visionary leaders. Speaking on behalf of them and their hospitals, I'm honored to announce today a new hospital-led initiative in the city of Chicago to make this city safer and healthier, a partnership to reduce gun violence and healthcare inequities in our cities. It's called the Chicago HEAL Initiative. HEAL stands for Hospital Engagement, Action, and Leadership. And that is what's driving this initiative. The hospitals themselves. This is responsible corporate citizenship in action. I'm going to mention the names of all of these 10 executives. Hold your applause. Some of them have already been introduced, but I want to mention them. Each of them deserves applause, but hang on. From Advocate Christ, President Matt Premack. From Ann and Robert Lurie, Children's Hospital, Pat Magoon, my friend. Cook County Health and Hospital System, Dr. Jay Shannon, another, they're all my friends. From Loyola University Medical Center, Interim CEO Robert Spolman couldn't make it, but he sent Dr. Mark Cishon, I saw earlier, Professor and Chair of Emergency Medicine. Northwestern Memorial Hospital, Dean Harrison was here earlier, and I know their representative's still here, Rob Christie included. From Amita Health, Martin Judd, CEO of Saints Mary and Elizabeth Medical Center. Rush University Medical Center, Dr. Larry Goodman. Sinai Health System, Karen Tietelbaum, University of Chicago Medical Center, Ken Polanski, and from the University of Illinois Hospital and Health Sciences, CEO Michael Zinn. Give them a round of applause, please. So it's time for a quiz here. Do you know what they call a group of owls? This is the truth, literally. A parliament. Do you know what they call a group of porcupines? A prickle. And what do they call it when 10 CEOs of hospitals that compete between themselves every single day of the year decide to sit down together, break bread, and see what they can do together? I think you'd call it a miracle. A.J. Wilhelmy, raise your hand. A.J. Wilhelmy is the CEO of the Illinois Health and Hospital Association. We asked him, do you know of any other city in America where the major hospitals, 10 hospitals, are coming together to deal with these types of public health problems and violence? And the answer was no. This is a first. What we're announcing today has no precedent. And in this room are a lot of amazing people who do this every single day as well. The hospitals, 30 or more, that are in the Cook County area, in the neighborhoods and communities, are and that really do things that are extraordinary, are part of this effort, as well as so many other organizations that are here. I thank you all for what you're doing. I want to make it clear from the start, the Chicago HEAL Initiative is not a federal mandate. It's grassroots. It started in Chicago by Chicagoans, and it's led by the Chicago hospitals. It grew out of a meeting we had 9 months ago when some said for the first time, we're all sitting at the same table. We brought them together just to talk about this and what we could do. What can you do in your neighborhood? What is your neighborhood for each one of these hospitals? We learned that two important developments came out of the meeting. First, it's clear that every hospital was already doing something. to prevent violence and to improve health in the neighborhood. I asked him, what can I do? And there are more ways that you can extend your influence. How can you extend your influence beyond the four walls of your hospital? How can you use your economic clout to create jobs and new hope in neighborhoods? How can we come up with the best practices? And here was the biggest challenge. Can we agree, all 10 of us, and myself included, on common goals, spell them out, write them out, hold ourselves accountable? And they said they were willing to do it. So for the last 9 or 10 months, we've been engaged in that effort. I want to give a special shout out to my chief of staff and a couple of my staff members who have put more time in this than you can imagine. Claudia Sol Duque, where are you? Sitting next to Christian Mitchell is Max Kanner from Washington. Max, thank you for coming. Somehow he works in my office, and he's going to law school, and he worked on this. Joseph Tennille. Joseph, please stand up. So we started off by saying, let's look at the city of Chicago. Let's look where the gun violence is taking place, where the public health outcomes are the most disappointing, and let's make sure that they're part of a neighborhood for some hospital. And we started going through the communities. I could give you the long list, and it is long. But when it was all said and done, there are still some gaps that we need to fill. But the neighborhoods that you read about every morning or hear on the news are the ones that we are focusing on. These are part of the Chicago HEAL initiative because they have these challenges. The highest murder rates in the city, in some cases 3 or 4 times as many murders as city average. The highest rates of poverty and unemployment in the city, and the lowest percentage of people with diplomas. The residents tend to live sicker, die younger than most Chicagoans who live just a few miles away. But here's something else to keep in mind about those neighborhoods. In addition to the disadvantages, they have remarkable strengths. These are hardworking, talented, resilient people in all of these neighborhoods. One of them, South Shore, produced the First Lady of the United States, Michelle Obama. I talked about this disparity in the life expectancy between Loop and East Garfield Park. Consider this. Even if folks in higher crime neighborhoods like North Lawndale had access to the same hospitals and doctors as those on the North Shore, it's likely you'd still see a big difference in life expectancy. Why? Research tells us that medical care accounts for 10 to 20% of what experts say are our health outcomes. That's how healthy we are and how long we live. So what else is part of the health outcome equation? Our own behavior? Diet and exercise, smoking, drug and alcohol use, lifestyle factors, 30%. But what is the even greater impact on our health and how long we live? Everything else. What the experts refer to as social determinants of health. They're factors outside of the hospital or doctor's office that affect health and longevity. The trauma caused by violence. The persistent threat of violence. The toxic stress that trauma causes. Major social determinants of health. 20 years of research have shown us that experience repeated trauma leaves scars on children that need to be addressed. The changes can lead to emotional difficulties, developmental delays, learning problems, all factors that are perpetuated by violence and poverty. Without help, adults who experience violence and other trauma as kids are more likely to suffer heart disease, liver and lung disease, stroke, diabetes, depression, addiction, and so many other chronic health conditions. The Chicago HEAL Initiative hospitals know that. That's why they're making it a priority to screen for trauma and helping trauma sufferers find the help to heal. Other social determinants, economic stability, education, transportation, housing. If we're serious about reducing gun violence, we're going to have to deal with trauma and other social determinants. It's not enough. Not enough, though I wish we could. It's not enough just to get the guns out of the neighborhoods. We need to bring jobs into the neighborhoods. We need more safe and affordable housing. We need fewer food deserts and more healthy food choices. We need to make it easier for people to get to medical care and mental health services outside of hospitals. Places like schools, community centers, YMCAs. Make no mistake, these hospitals cannot do this alone. And they can't do it without the community buy-in. But they can really identify and rally the best players in the public, private sectors, and in the neighborhoods. The hospitals are already working on a lot of these areas. They're partnering with schools and community groups to recruit, hire, and train neighborhood residents for good jobs. They're increasing the amount of goods and services they purchase from their neighborhoods. They are offering mentorships and paid internships to attract young people in the healthcare industry, expanding diversity in the healthcare workforce, investing in safe and affordable housing, and training workers. I want to tell you about some specific programs, but first I'm going to introduce a short video. Before it starts, I want to thank my dear friend Rick Jaskolka and Jim Turman of Jaskolka Turman, who put this together for nothing because we just happen to be buddies and they always come when I call. And I particularly want to thank Lauren Jaskolka, who couldn't be here this morning, but she was the producer, director, and the inspiration. Let's show this 3-minute video.
Chicago neighborhood violence is an epidemic. Gunfire has shattered too many innocent lives and left a lasting impact on our communities. We need solutions. There are too many guns on our streets and too few police resources. But even successfully addressing these two important challenges will not solve this crisis. Foundations, community organizations, and corporations have all stepped up to support initiatives that holistically address the root causes of this cycle of violence in our city. And hospitals have been on the front lines addressing this Herculean challenge, both with medical care as well as with bold initiatives designed to lift up vulnerable communities by planting seeds of hope to replace the endless cycle of despair. Yet, if hospitals can have tremendous impact individually, just think about what they might accomplish working together, collaborating to reduce gun violence and improve the health of communities and those who live and work there. For months, Senator Dick Durbin has been convening the leadership of the 10 largest hospitals serving Chicago and has asked them 3 basic questions.
What are you doing to make the neighborhoods around your hospital safer? What are you doing to improve the health and economic opportunities of the residents of those neighborhoods? What more can you do? And what can I do to help? Their answers have led to the HEAL Initiative, Hospital Engagement, Action, and Leadership. It's an action plan that collaboratively channels the tremendous leadership, commitment, and resources of these 10 amazing hospitals to have a positive impact on the 18 underserved neighborhoods in Chicago. The goal is to reduce violence, but it's also to improve the health and economic well-being of those who live there. Of course, these 10 hospitals are already doing a lot of important work inside their walls and outside in the community. The HEAL Initiative provides a focused plan to invest in the local workforce, support community partnerships and programs, and improve medical practices to address unmet health needs. Whatever it takes, cutting through red tape in Washington, bringing home federal dollars through grants, or merely convening the leaders of these amazing hospitals, I want to do my part to make Chicago HEAL succeed. We all have our eyes wide open. Progress may be slow, but it needs to be steady if we really want to save lives and communities and open the door of opportunity to more city residents. I look forward to working with these outstanding hospitals as they collaborate to build a brighter, safer future for all of Chicago. We don't have time to tell you about all the programs. But let me tell you about a few so you get a feel for what we're talking about. Amita Health, partnering with CARA, which comes from my parish here, Old St. Pat's, and Safer Foundation, who they're here today, to create jobs for ex-offenders, giving them a second chance. UIC Hospitals found that an inordinate share of its ER budget was spent treating homeless people. They created healing through housing programs to help more move critically homeless people in safe housing. The formerly homeless patients are healthier now, and the hospital is actually saving money. Cook County Hospital and the University of Chicago Medical Center are partners in a violence prevention program called Healing Hurt People. Young men who are treated at the hospital for gunshot and violent injury are screened by specially trained staff. Those exhibiting signs of trauma are offered a chance to take part in an intensive program of healing and support. More than 500 young men have completed this program. Any results yet? 87% of the graduates avoided involvement with the criminal justice system. 87%. 89% avoided re-injury. 98% have not retaliated for their injury. We can break this violent cycle. We can do it with these types of programs. It saves money and it will save lives. Since the first meeting we had in January, we've met several times together, staff executives at my office, other hospitals. We've worked to come up with a game plan. We've written it down, specifics as to what we hope to achieve. 16 goals and commitments endorsed by all 10 hospitals. It's a unified platform. Over the next 3 years, we've set a timetable. Well, this isn't the creation of a bureaucracy that never goes away. We hope it's the creation of a movement that can build on itself. Over the next 3 years, we want to expand economic opportunity. Let me be specific. Increase hiring from the 18 Chicago HEAL neighborhoods by 15%. That means hundreds, even thousands, of new hires from these 18 focused neighborhoods. Increase the goods and services the hospitals purchase from local businesses by 20%. That means millions of dollars in procurement going right into the neighborhoods and communities of the city of Chicago. Expand summer employment, paid internships, apprenticeships, job training programs for local residents and health fields and partner corporations and organizations. Terry Peterson and I sat down and talked about this months ago, but the notion is to bring those young kids in to shadow some people in this case, Rush Hospital, and see what life is like. If you finish school, if you'll go across the street to Malcolm X or to another one of the city colleges, one, and pick up the degree you need to be part of the workforce at Rush, one of the illustrations. The 10 HEAL hospitals are committing to improving health and decrease health inequities by opening new health clinics in schools. Ms. Jackson, I hope that's good news for you. Community centers and other community settings where people are most likely to use them. Expanding the availability of mental health services in the community. Increase lead screening for Medicaid-eligible kids by 15%. Support efforts to improve maternal and infant health outcomes, a dramatic challenge, especially for mothers and babies of color. They also will help in the opioid epidemic by reducing opioid prescriptions by 20%. Expand their research into gun violence. Train their employees on how to talk to patients and others about the dangers of guns. We're making progress. In fact, I want to, as we come to the close here, share a little news with you. In the spirit of Chicago HEAL, executives from two hospitals in our initiative, Advocate Christ and the University of Chicago Medical Center, sat down together after our first meeting. They pulled out a map and they compared the zip codes of the patients they serve. They discovered a lot of their patients with gun wounds and other violent injuries were bouncing back and forth between both hospitals. So now they're planning to work together to train their intake staffs to become trauma-informed. They expect that by recognizing trauma and referring patients for care, they can reduce rates of retaliation and re-injury. And they have plans for more, building the workforce, increasing access. I want to commend them for their leadership. My role in this is not just simply to be a supporting partner. I have work to do, making sure that we don't see the Affordable Care Act go by the way, make sure that we continue to expand the reach of health insurance for more and more people across the United States. Fighting for Medicaid and Medicare, child nutrition, infant maternal health programs, community health centers, as well as affordable housing, child care, education, and job training. Which brings me to another bit of news. This morning I'm announcing three new federal grants, $1.1 million, to support Chicago hospitals and community organizations in improving mental health services. These grants come from federal budget lines that I have specifically fought for and secured. They include a grant to the University of Chicago to support a program that provides young victims of violence with mentoring and counseling. There's also a grant to UIC to train 20 new master's-level social workers to provide behavioral health treatment in three federally qualified health centers, Howard Brown, Lawndale Christian, and Prime Care Community Health. A little over 50 years ago, Dr. Martin Luther King moved to Chicago. He and Coretta moved into a cold water flat in a rundown tenement building on South Hamlin Avenue in North Lawndale. Dr. King said he chose Chicago because it had the same problems as all American cities, maybe just a little bit more of some of them. And if Chicago could embrace change, he said, that would show that any city in America could. No community in America is safe from gun violence, but Chicago has more gun violence than many communities. And if you are like me, I'm sick of it. The announcement today is just a beginning. Leaders and staff of the hospitals in Chicago Heal will continue to meet regularly, sharing ideas, identifying gaps, and partnering in new projects. They need partners in the community, and many are sitting in this room. We're going to work with you and other organizations. In fact, if you have good ideas or strategies and want to lend your support, we welcome your insight. We'll be measuring progress and sharing with the public. We believe that Chicago can reduce gun violence and show the way for the rest of the country. I hope you'll join with me in healing Chicago. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator Durbin, and we have time for a few questions. If there's anybody that hasn't submitted a question, if you fill out the blue form, we have members of our staff who will go around, pick them up. We'll try to answer as many questions as possible. Senator, this is from City Club member Elise Cutler with Sage Health Strategy. What will the Democrats, capital D, top legislative priority be, should you retake the Senate?
In their wisdom, our founding fathers created three branches of government and something called checks and balances. I sincerely believe that our first priority is to make sure that we are faithful to that, to make certain that no one goes too far in either branch of government, any of the branches of government for that matter. If you're asking for specific subject matters, we still have an immigration issue that's out there. We have 800,000 DACA recipients who are hanging on by a court protective order. They could find themselves in a position tomorrow where they're facing deportation. I'll tell you about one of them. She's, as Phil Herrick can tell you, she's a student at Loyola Medical School. Loyola Medical School in Chicago has done more than any medical school in the United States to accept DACA students. How many, Phil?
Right now it's
36. 36, dramatically more than any other school. And when they finish at Loyola, doctors in the room know, you head for a residency. A residency is actually employment, where you work. If you are undocumented, you cannot legally work in this country. That's the end of their medical education. They can't pursue a residency in the United States, just to give you a practical impact of the end of DACA and the loss of extraordinary talent. There's one DACA recipient from India, I believe, that I've met out at your school, and she is in this dilemma. Finding it hard to get a residency because there's no certainty in terms of her employment status and immigration status. So that is certainly a high priority. Healthcare, the driving issue in this election, despite everything you've heard in every single district, is healthcare over and over again. We see all these different issues about the Supreme Court and foreign policy and other things coming and growing. But when we get back together, we've got to do more when it comes to healthcare. So I'd say immigration and healthcare are the two first.
Thank you. This question isn't about health care, but in a way it is, if you broadly define it. This is from Holly Agra, Chicago's First Lady Cruises, City Club member. Senator, do you think a bill to increase the amount of legroom on airplanes will actually pass? Hey, if you ride on planes, it's an important question.
I ride on more planes than anybody in the room. No. I don't think so. No, and I wish they would, but it is very unlikely that, particularly with this Congress and President, that sort of bill would pass.
Okay. This is from City Club member Don Schellenberger. Is this FBI investigation going to make any difference? Isn't this all about political philosophy?
Okay.
It's a very long.
I can't answer about whether it will make a difference. All I've said, and I hope most people agree, keep the politicians out of it. Give the FBI the charges that have been made in three specific instances and let them investigate. Let them decide which witnesses and what evidence need to be collected. And then it's up to us to read what they found and come to a conclusion about the truth of allegations that have been made. There is clearly a major difference in philosophy between the parties as to what they want to see on the Supreme Court. And it was a big driver in the last election on the Republican side. It still is a big driver in terms of their political outcomes. But then we had a clash, a convergence of the Me Too movement and the Supreme Court nomination. And it has created a scene which I'm just amazed how many people witnessed last week. How many of you watched the hearings in Washington last week? Wow. That doesn't happen very often. You usually find other things to do when we're talking out in Washington. But I think it brought together so many important and timely and contemporary issues. I don't know how it's going to be resolved. I don't know how it will end. The jury in this case consists of three senators, Jeff Flake, Lisa Murkowski, and Susan Collins. If they believe that Judge Kavanaugh should be elevated to the Supreme Court, it will happen. That's just a fact. Numbers count. If they have questions about it or oppose him, it could be a different outcome. The FBI report may have some impact on them.
Okay, thank you very much. This is from Dory McWhorter with the YWCA of Metropolitan Chicago. Are there any plans for Chicago Heal to leverage innovations coming out of MATTER, the Health Innovation Incubator, to support goals of the initiative?
That was one of the things we discussed in our meeting on Saturday, was trying to exchange data so that these hospitals can learn from one another. And that certainly applies to other organizations. YW has really done some amazing things. I had a meeting with representatives of YW on this whole issue of sexual harassment, for example, just a week ago. There is a lot to be said and a lot that we can gather from that. I hope I didn't create the idea that there are walls being built around this organization. It's all doors and openings and opportunities for others to be part of it, and we welcome their participation.
Thank you, Senator. This is from City Club member Zawiya McElrath with Year Up Chicago. And I think you may have answered some of this in your address. What role can hospitals play in hiring talented 18 to 24-year-olds and thereby decrease violence in our neighborhoods?
I mentioned my conversation with Terry, and I think that this idea of summer employment, internships, shadowing out of the employees, many of these young people have never visualized anything other than a very sad and depressing existence. And if they can see others who have broken out from that and created good, fulfilling lives, I know what it meant to me. Each one of us can point at some point in our lives to a mentor, a coach, a pastor, someone who made a big difference, a family member in your life. And I hope that this kind of could lead to their being inspired to continue in school and to pursue even higher levels of education than they planned.
Thank you. This is from City Club non-member Ryan Butts. Ryan, you get one question if you're a non-member. We expect you to join. $35, you're a member. No DNA testing or anything. He's with the March of Dimes. Question, what are senators working on to help improve health equity for moms?
I hope you know that this is a horrible statistic in the United States in terms of maternal and young child mortality in this country, especially bad among minority groups. It is incredible that we are falling so far behind the rest of the world in terms of the survival of mothers and their infants. And there are many initiatives taking a look at what's behind it. I'm not expert as to what they're going to find, but shame on us. There was a time not that long ago when a member of my staff, Anne Marie Murphy, some of you may know Anne Marie, decided to tackle the inequities in breast cancer in the city of Chicago that were largely driven by race and poverty. They've made dramatic progress. Other cities are now coming to see what they've done in terms of public education to make a difference. It can be done, but we've got to focus on it and make sure we work with the hospitals and community health care clinics as well as the professionals to find the way through this. This is just unacceptable. Regardless of your views on any of the social issues before Washington today, I hope we can all agree that surviving mothers and babies ought to be our high priority.
Okay, and by the way, folks, if you want to hear this program again, we do a podcast over WGN Radio, so I just want to bring that to your attention. Senator, two questions here that are somewhat related. One by Courtney Hederman with AARP, and one from Natalie Laxick with the Center on Halsted. And they deal with how can community organizations that receive, for example, VOCA and ICJIA funding be involved, and where could they find a list of the neighborhoods in the HEAL initiative?
I had the list, but it was so long I tried not to save you a little time and not read it, but we will certainly make it available to you. I don't know what those initials stand for. I'm sorry. But give me a word clue.
Victim of crime.
The victims of crime? I don't know, Kwame, how we're approaching that now. And
well, actually, Advocate is the grant recipient of VOCA funding for trauma recovery.
So Advocate is already, Matt, you're already involved in that? Great. So some of the hospitals are showing leadership on this, and I hope that that becomes something they all do.
Okay. Couple last questions. This is from Claude Robinson with UCAR. Printing is always very important. You know, it's hard. Don't forget, I'm a graduate of Lafayette Grammar School. The other famous person, Saul Bellow. Okay. Anyhow, this deals with the HEAL initiative, and will there be percentages for MBE and WBE construction spending and so on in the plan?
Yes, as far as I'm concerned, I think we need to make that commitment at the front end of this. We need community buy-in. That's one of the critical elements. You've seen that over and over again, whether it's President Obama's library or whatever it may be. You need community buy-in. And I think making certain that we have minority businesses, minority employees, as well as those representing other organizations like that, is essential for that to occur. I hope that that becomes a major part of what we do. I wanted to just say, kind of a general observation politically, because I had something on my schedule last Friday, I was unable to come back to Chicago for a meeting with the African American Caucus of the City Council. But I have met with the Latino Caucus, and they are enthusiastic in support of this idea, as I believe the others will be too. The other thing I'll say is when the dust finally settles and we have a list of mayoral aspirants, it'll be a long list, I'm sure. But I'm going to call them all together for bagels and coffee and present this. I want all of them to consider it seriously as part of the future of this city. I just believe whoever is elected that this is could be a valuable tool.
Thank you. Thank you. Two last questions. This is from Charles Smead, City Club member. After watching last week's hearings in that, do you think that Lindsey Graham is angling to be a candidate for Attorney General should Jeff Sessions leave that office?
This is way beyond any expertise that I have. Now, here's something you may find hard to believe. Lindsey's my friend. Lindsey is my co-sponsor of the DACA legislation. We've worked on immigration reform together. We've worked on criminal justice reform together. Now, each of us has our moments. But I've come to understand that today's confrontation may tomorrow need to be collaboration. And I'm not angry at him, nor do I take anything he said personally. I want to be able to work with him on many things. And he is a talented man who, being a conservative Republican from South Carolina, has done some exceptional things, moving to the progressive side. So he obviously felt strongly at the moment. He expressed himself, but tomorrow's another day.
Okay. Now, Senator Durbin offered his answers and opinions on a lot of matters relating to domestic affairs, including health and others. This is a foreign policy question from Robert Naaman. I think he's way in the back there. He's with Just Foreign Policy. What will you do now to end the unconstitutional U.S. participation in the catastrophic Saudi war in Yemen? And what will you do in the future to stop such unconstitutional wars from starting in the first place?
It looks like the Syrian war is drawing to a close after some 400,000 people have died and millions have been displaced and just untold human suffering as a result of it. I don't like the ending, but it's time for it to end. Then we'd have to turn our sights on Yemen, because what's happening in Yemen is comparable in terms of the actual loss of human life, not only from the bombing, but also from famine that is rampant in that country. A terrible battle is underway between the Saudis and Iran with surrogate forces involved in it. And the United States is involved. We are providing air support and logistical support on the Saudi side. Robert and I have talked about this at length on several occasions. I can just tell you that when 17 years ago we faced a vote after 9/11 on whether to invade Iraq, there were 23 of us in the Senate who voted no. And voting no, believed that that was just not the thing to do, and the evidence wasn't strong enough to compel it. Remember the evidence, weapons of mass destruction, never showed up, never found them. There was a second vote that came right on the heels of it, and that was whether to initiate the war in Afghanistan. Different story. There were no dissenting votes in the Senate, only one in the House of Representatives. That was the haven, that was the source of the terrorists who struck us on 9/11. And many of us felt that we had to make it clear. We were not going to sit back and allow 3,000 innocent Americans to die without striking back. And we did in Afghanistan. I voted for that. I never believed when I was casting that vote I was voting for the longest war in the history of the United States. It goes on to this day with thousands of Americans who've died, not to mention Afghans and others who've died in the process, and there is no end in sight. Many of us are stepping up and saying, if the Constitution means anything, Congress has to assert its responsibility to declare war. That is what we're supposed to do on behalf of you, and we have stepped away from that. So we are talking about a new conversation and debate on the War Powers Act. I'm for it. As tough as those votes are, that is my constitutional responsibility as long as I serve in the Senate.
Let's give Senator Durbin a big round of applause.